Hi, this is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. It is our Tuesday edition. As you come to expect, we Zoom on Monday in order for you to hear on Tuesday. We have begun every show for the last couple of weeks, and we will continue to do so between now and November of 2020 with the powerful words of Colonel Vindman when he was testifying before the impeachment hearing in the fall of 2019. Those are important words. We want those words ringing in your ears as you go into the election booth. And as he sort of told his father, it would be all right. And what we've come to learn, it was not all right for him. It was not all right for his brother. And it's clearly not all right for the rest of us. So now the words of Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
All right, joining us is my good friend, Russ Muirhead. He is the chairman of the government department at Dartmouth College. And it is always a pleasure to chat with him. There is so much chaos going on in the world. I just can't even believe it. I'm looking at the November election and I'm getting terrified. I'm getting terrified, Russ, because I saw what happened in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin is pivotal for the fact that, you know, if the Democrats are going to win in November, they have to win Wisconsin. Wisconsin was a complete meltdown, total chaos. The GOP insisted upon having an election, even though there's a pandemic. The Supreme Court seemed to rubber stamp that. The Wisconsin Supreme Court seemed to rubber stamp that. The Republicans that control the legislature rubber stamped that. And I'm just trying to figure out what kind of risks we're going to be asking people to basically embrace in order to vote in November. And then what is the message of this election? That's, I think, the other thing is, I'm not even sure, like, what does Biden say and what does Trump say as we decide to exercise the franchise? A lot on your plate.
Anyway. Yeah. I know, and that the core question is, like, what are the risks? And you know, do our leaders really care about making it safe to vote? And now we have one party that's out of the closet. They're just out there saying, we don't want people to vote. If people vote, we lose. Donald Trump just said it. He said it right as plainly as can be. They're finally not lying anymore. They're not hiding behind the fig leaf of voter fraud. They're just saying, we don't want people to vote. We can't win elections when everybody
votes.
Not
lying about this anyway.
Yeah.
And I actually think that by November, it's going to be a lot safer than it was when people very courageously went out to vote in Wisconsin. And I think that I think that people are going to, you know, it's going to be a different world in November, and it's going to be much, much safer. And so there will be less to worry about. At the same time, we need to take steps to make it safe for everybody, including people whose immune systems can't handle confronting this virus, such as just about everybody over 80. I mean, Donald Trump's going to disenfranchise everybody over 80.
Well, he's only if they survive. I mean, I hate to break it to you, but I feel like this is almost strategic that it's old people in nursing homes. It's people of color and Hispanics. It's poor people who have always lacked access to healthcare. It's both documented and undocumented immigrants. Yeah. I mean, when you look at where the agenda is, it almost feels like it's checking off all the boxes of all the people.
Listen, sometimes I wish it were strategic. I wish it were. I mean, I wish Donald had a strategy. what we're looking at is incompetence. So many of his supporters are going to be vulnerable to this disease. So many of his supporters have diabetes. So many of his supporters have compromised immune systems. So many of his supporters have sporadic access to healthcare.
Right.
So many of his supporters are in rural areas where hospitals are going to be overwhelmed. I mean, I wish it were. I wish that you could say he cared about some people, just his people. But I think what we're looking at is something even more negligent than that.
So I just posted something on Facebook because I've been thinking a lot about messaging going into 2020. And historically, it used to be, are you better off today than you were 4 years ago? That's been the sort of historic message. And, you know, given that incredible economy up until the pandemic, he had a real edge. I mean, Wall Street was going berserk. We had the lowest unemployment. I mean, there was huge inequality gaps, but hey, you know, that's America for you. So I am now looking at the pandemic and his inability to respond. And in a way, maybe his pressers are a gift, because every time he opens his mouth, you see his numbers begin to continue to drop, because people are now looking at him where he's shutting up the scientists and shutting up the doctors and lying through his teeth. So I think the message for 2020 is, do you feel safe with this president?
Do you feel safe?
And that is, never before has that question been asked in the way that it truly resonates on a lot of levels. And safe can mean economically safe. Safe can mean whether you survive. Safe can mean whether you think that the agenda going forward is something that will offer you a semblance of security. I just think the idea of feeling safe is so interesting. And that's where Biden's asset comes in. Not because of Joe, but because all of a sudden, you know who's going to come out of the other closet? It's going to be Barack Obama. This is going to be Barack Obama's third term. It's going to be because Joe doesn't present himself well. Joe doesn't have, isn't articulate and compassionate. And every time I see him, he looks older than the day before. But what I do see happening is that because he ran as Barack Obama in a lot of ways, you are going to see more and more of Barack Obama, and that charm and steadiness and golden tongue and stability. And all of a sudden, you're going to basically assume that whatever is Barack is also Biden.
Yeah, I think it's a brilliant slogan. I remember years ago, I was hiring somebody and I called a reference and I said, you know, can you give me some information about her? And they said, she's a safe pair of hands. And that's what you mean by safe. Biden is a safe pair of hands.
That's a safe pair of hands. That's exactly what you want, because it's a safe pair of hands on whether they sign bills into law. It's a safe pair of hands when they're basically signing a contract to get you N95s. It's a safe pair of hands. That's really what has to happen. And I know a lot of the progressives are going to be upset about the fact that but you know, right now, I think the idea is safe. You can also sort of say, but that's also safe when you look at climate change. That's also safe when you look at healthcare, because now we're redefining safety given what the pandemic has exposed, Russ.
Yeah, and the progressives are going to get, I mean, a lot closer to what they want, you know, even without Bernie. And part of it's just, you know, circumstances. I think what we're going to look at is the end of the big military. I think that pandemic spending is going to finally make clear to Congress that we can't afford a military that costs, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars and loses every war it fights.
Yeah.
And you know, we just can't afford it. It's nice to have, I suppose, you know, if it's just fun to have around, but we can't afford to keep doing it. So I think, we're going to see something much closer to universal health care. What this pandemic is making clear is that everybody's got to have access to health care. It's a public health necessity. Okay. It's not just a right. It's about a safe community. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also making clear the logic of something like, you know, a much more extensive safety net that catches independent contractors and people who are outside of old-fashioned employment relationships, whether that's a guaranteed basic income or, you know, beefed up unemployment or something like that. So I think, you know, we're going to have to get more progressive, whoever's in charge.
Well, you know what? The military knows this. The military knows. No, they actually do.
I think you're right.
No, I swear to God, the military understands climate change. They've been talking about it. The military understands healthcare. They even understand that safety net. I'll never forget talking to a soldier who had gone to Afghanistan And he thought that it was going to be his prowess at shooting and driving his heft, whatever the SUV he was driving, and all his military experience. And you know what he told me? He went, oh my God, Arnie, I had to be a social worker, not a soldier, a social worker. And he realized that in Afghanistan. And I think what the military is realizing is that they also have soft skills, not just the hard skills of dropping bombs and the hard skills of a Navy that's, you know, a military sub. They also know how to organize, how to coordinate, how to set up those field hospitals, how to respond to a pandemic, how to respond to climate change. It's a military, but it's not going to be about an M16. It's going to be a military that's a very, very different headset, but their organizational skills, the investment in them, the kinds of things that they're able to bring to the table, those are still going to cost us money, but it's not going to be the traditional things that Raytheon builds or, you know, Lockheed Martin. It's going to be different, but yet they're still going to be crucial.
You know, that alternate use of military money and forces reminds me a lot of, you know what, community policing. Yeah. Instead of having police be militarized and go out and shoot the bad guys, you have police who go out there. And as Arnie said, you know, they're not necessarily social workers, but they are humane. They are compassionate about other people's humanity, the community's humanity. And they go there and try to help make the community safer. And, you know, as if they're on our side, and they are.
All right. So here's the problem, Russ. The problem still is that because money and politics are still synonymous, because of the revolving door, because the military industrial complex has had such incredible control, it is going to be really interesting to see how you can disconnect that military industrial complex from building what they currently build to building what they have to build. And just today, again, reminding everyone, we're taping on Monday for Tuesday's show. There was a tornado, a huge tornado. 1 million people have lost their lights. Now they are facing two things. They're facing a weather event as they're facing the pandemic. And you know what? That's when you need a military too. Because they can come in with a level of equipment and sophistication that the healthcare system can't respond to and state government can't respond to, but they could, because multitasking has been something that they've been trained to do.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the question is, you know, what will cause all of us in the United States of America to realize that there's a limit to how much deficit spending we can indulge in? And so, you know, we think that the traditional line is that Democrats are deficit spenders. Well, of course, they're not. Democrats are very, very prudent, whether it's Bill Clinton or Barack Obama, very prudent about the budget. Republicans get in there and they spend like a bunch of, you know, I don't even want to say drunk sailors, because it's an insult to drunks and drunk sailors too.
Yeah.
And, you know, the $1 trillion a year deficit before we hit tough times. Now we're hitting tough times. What's it going to be, $5 trillion? Well, there is actually a limit. When we hit that limit, we're going to have to figure out what to cut. And I think that's the point where the military is going to end up being under a kind of pressure that it hasn't been under since 1990.
But, you know, I also think that we have to reteach the American people. And what we have to reteach them is that there are two kinds of debts and two kinds of deficits. There's the deficit and debt that you create because you've built something. Because you've built a healthcare system, because you've built a road system, because you've dealt with climate change and you're anticipating what the future is. What the Republicans do is that it's a hollow debt. You get nothing for it. You have no results. And so as I'm looking at this, and you have to, and again, I almost feel like it's so hard to teach people as you're in an election mode. But we never take the time to teach. And maybe because we're all stuck at home, and maybe because we're all not going to work, and maybe because we're all being told that we have to go to school online, this is an opportunity to have a captive voter and a captive citizen and say, this is it. Oh, my God.
You're so right. So how about this? Why isn't Nancy Pelosi having press conferences every day?
Yeah.
Oh. Everybody's at home. Why isn't she educating? Now, I understand why Joe isn't. I get why Joe isn't doing it. But you know what Joe should be doing? He should be taking a lesson from you, Arnie. He should start a talk show. He should go down to his basement, build himself a little bar, and have a talk show from his bar.
He has one. Wait.
No, why?
Because it's terrible. So let me just say something. So he's got a talk show, exactly right, but he's not a talk show host. And I'm going to be honest with you. I've developed that skill set over 40 years.
Right, okay.
And it is, as humble as I want to be, it is a skill. You have to be smart. You have to be charming. You have to be engaging. So let me give you an example. Today I did, this is Monday morning, I did a radio show in Texas, Central Texas, okay? This is a Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity, yada yada station. For whatever reason, they got my name and they wanted me to talk about Bernie and Biden. Okay, swear to God, this happened this morning. And so I am hilarious. I talk about the fact that I had Rush Limbaugh's producer come to my class at Harvard. I am, by the time I get done, all the Sean Hannity Rush people are like, I think I like this broad. Okay?
Right. Well, we know they love you. They're going to love you. They only need to meet you.
Yeah. But here's what I did. But out of that, I was able to teach. I was able to talk about the challenges and the issues that we are facing. I was talking about the deficits that are at the national level and the deficits that the governors are facing and what kinds of investments we make. And by the time I got done, the woman whose station it is, she's like laughing at me. She's going, so how often can you come back? Okay? So why I'm saying that is that you're absolutely right about Nancy Pelosi. Donald Trump has these campaign pressers. Nancy Pelosi should get Katie Porter, should get some of the best people to do these pressers, these press events, but they're like educational press events.
Right.
They explain the facts.
Andrew Cuomo knows how to do it.
Exactly. But it's only focused on COVID. And what I think Nancy could do is take the COVID story and weave in economics.
Mm. Yeah.
I really do. So doesn't she do it?
That most of the time, people don't see their political leaders and hear them. They're usually pretty invisible. And right now, people are watching CNN and they're seeing the governor of New York, the governor of California. They're seeing mayors. They're hearing them. And I think they're learning about like what a competent mayor or competent governor sounds like and what a competent leader sounds like. And this is what's really bad for Trump. This is why his approval ratings aren't where they should be. It should be 90% right now.
And
they're stuck. And they're stuck because people watch him and then they watch a real leader and they learn something.
Well, not that, but so we played yesterday on my radio show the words of Boris Johnson after he came out of the hospital.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you, I think Ken's listened to it 10 times. I've listened to it 20 times. I cry. You know, I'm like, but what is so powerful about what he did was that it was his level of humanity and humbleness, the idea that he identified individuals within the national health system, the idea that he understood that it was the beating heart of England, the beating heart. And so all my friends were saying to me, oh, but he's just like Trump, always a jerk, always this.
Yeah.
And let me also say why I want Nancy Pelosi to have some kind of an event every day, giving us the facts and the truth. And that is, I always tell the story of Alfred Nobel. And the story goes that Alfred Nobel had invented dynamite and became incredibly rich. But Alfred Nobel's brother died before he did. And this French newspaper wrote Alfred Nobel's obituary. And he got to read his own obituary before he died. And they referred to him as the Prince of Darkness because of dynamite and how much destruction it had done to the planet. And he reads his obituary and he flips out and he calls his friend who he had known for years, who's this sort of peacenik, and says, what do I do? And the apocryphal tale is, she says, you have time to rewrite your obituary. And when I heard Boris Johnson, I kept thinking of Alfred Nobel. And I want Nancy Pelosi to sort of have this conversation with America and say, these are our failures. And if we don't deal with them, this is our obituary, but we have the opportunity and the policy and the great minds to make sure that it's not. And it would be remarkable and such a contrast to him. And even if Joe can't do it, Nancy can find someone that can, and then it can be, he can sort of sanction it. He can sort of remind people about it. And that would be a win-win for him.
Yeah. Is there something Joe can do?
He can lead from behind.
Huh.
And the
that's
reason
good.
Why...
That's good.
He's and that is good.
There's a famous, there's a quote that is, that's attributed to Gandhi. Excuse me, I have to go catch up with my followers.
Yes, yes, yes. So the reason why leading from behind is so perfect for Joe is that he's never been a great thinker. He's never been the initiator. He always sort of follows what's happening within the pack, okay? And what I see happening to him is that who has set the agenda and the pack has been Bernie and the progressives. And they've been aided and abetted with the, 2008 economic meltdown, with the war in Iraq, with 9/11, with student debt. All those things helped to give Bernie sort of a foundation for his message. And that really, I think, has captured a lot of the imagination, not just of the Bernie folks, but actually of America. And what he can basically do is then follow their lead and say, I hear you. Now let's figure out how to make it happen. And he's already doing it, Russ. He's already doing it. You know that.
Yeah.
So how do we convince the voter that following from behind may be something we really need right now? Because what we saw with Trump is he's destroyed everything. And what we need to do is rebuild everything.
Yeah. And like you say, maybe it's that, say a safe pair of hands is what the times call for.
I love it. I love it. Yeah. So, and I think people want that. That just feels, what a safe pair of hands also is? We can't touch each other right now. All right?
Yeah, right.
Think of, no. We have to be 6 feet apart.
Yeah.
And I lost Marty in 2013. And the thing I miss the most is the safe pair of hands.
Yeah.
It's someone to hold my hand. It's someone to hug me.
Yeah.
And the idea of a safe pair of hands, especially because of the pandemic, we want to be hugged again.
Yeah.
And Joe is good at hugging.
Yeah.
And what he says and what he can say is, I will be your safe pair of hands. We will be able to hug again.
Yeah.
Just give me the chance.
Yeah.
I would cry. I would cry. And it would be a good cry because I think it's what America wants. I think so. So who do you know that knows Biden?
I know. I don't know who's down in that basement with him.
I know. That's the other thing. And last but not least, I know we only have a few minutes left and then we're going to grab our second guest, is that you heard that Bloomberg's people are trying to take over his campaign. Have you heard that?
Oh, is that right? Well, they did so well with their campaign. I guess why not?
Well, but you know what's interesting is that they are the brightest people on the planet. There's no question that he had the brightest people around him. There's an arrogance about Bloomberg that was hard to deal with. And it might have worked in New York, but of course in New York he was able to buy every vote and the Democrats kind of loved him because he got rid of term limits, you know what I mean? So he was able, and New York is such a quirky place. I think they actually have more to work with Biden, believe it or not, than they do with Bloomberg. And as much as my friends are hysterical that I'm even suggesting that Bloomberg's people might help, I'll tell you right now, whoever's working with Biden now, they suck.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
They're not doing a good job. And maybe what we need to do is take some of the progressive Bernie people to work with some of the sophisticated Bloomberg people.
Yeah.
And you would get, I think, a pretty remarkable campaign.
Or how about Elizabeth Warren and her people?
Well,
herself and her people would be great doing this.
I've very rarely seen a campaign that was organized more badly than the Biden campaign.
Exactly.
The primary.
Exactly.
I mean, I've never seen anything so incompetent. They just couldn't knock on doors. They couldn't do the basic stuff that other campaigns were doing. And he prevailed anyway because he has a lot of experience and he has a big reservoir of trust among classic Democratic constituencies.
He you know what? This is the Jim Clyburn presidency. Come on, this is a come to Jesus moment. This was got nothing to do with Biden. It had everything to do with Clyburn. And I think if Clyburn wants to do anything, then Clyburn needs to help him put together the team. He didn't want to endorse Joe Biden, but Bernie scared him. I get it. Well, now this is on your plate, Jim. And what you have to do is explain to him, you're running a lousy presidential campaign. Let's figure it out. But don't you dare leave the Bernie and the Elizabeth people at the back of the bus. Make sure that this is kind of more of a group grope and that you sort of combine forces. But in the end, if Jim Clyburn doesn't want to have egg all over his face in November of 2020, because I placed Biden at his feet, now if he's at his feet, he better help figure out how to run this campaign.
I mean, I really think, Arnie, it's not just Jim. It's also the fact that this guy, Biden, you know, he's been contributing to the common good through public office his whole life. People know who he was, and black people know who he was. And he worked for a black boss.
He worked for a black boss.
And he respected that boss, and he took directions from that boss, and he looks up to that boss. And so you can't be that racist as a white guy and have a black boss you adore and love and follow. So
I think black folks happen to be pretty darn competent.
Yeah, but that's a bit, think about it. But once again, he followed a black boss. Jim Clyburn was his next boss. Unbelievable. I love the show. All right, Russ Muirhead, I adore you. We go off on tangents and I go with nobody else. But the idea of the hands and the idea of the black boss, and you look at Barack Obama and Jim Clyburn, and I think African-Americans can say, absolutely, I'll go to the mat for you. And people will realize there's a level of humbleness to him because he doesn't walk in with that total package of white privilege. He walks in saying, I can work for quality people no matter who they are. And that's leading from behind. Remember that, Russ Muirhead. All right. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it. All right. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude. When we come back, we're going to be talking about state budgets. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1873. That was the day the single most deadly incident of the Reconstruction era occurred, known as the Colfax Massacre. As many as 150 black Republicans in Colfax, Louisiana, were slaughtered by white supremacists determined to destroy advances made by the formerly enslaved. Results of the 1872 gubernatorial election in Louisiana had been hotly contested. President Ulysses S. Grant ordered federal troops in to support the Republican winner, William Pitt Kellogg. A number of black radical Republicans had also won or retained local and state political positions. William Ward, a black Civil War veteran and militia leader, had won a seat in the state legislature. By the beginning of April, he and others were being threatened with attacks on the Grant Parish Courthouse in Colfax and lynchings by defeated white Southern Democrats. Desperate for backup, Ward and others left for New Orleans to appeal for federal reinforcement. On the Holy Easter Sunday, ex-Confederates, Klansmen, and Democrats rode into Colfax armed with guns, rifles, knives, and a cannon. 150 black Republicans were ready to defend their courthouse. Fighting raged on for hours, but eventually black Republicans were forced to retreat and then were massacred. 97 whites were indicted on federal conspiracy charges under the 1870 Enforcement Act, designed to enforce civil rights and root out Klan terror. The case went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and resulted in the ruling United States versus Cruikshank, which essentially gutted the Enforcement Act. Of the 97 indicted, 9 were tried, and 3 were initially found guilty. The Cruikshank ruling eventually overturned their convictions and effectively marked the legal end of Reconstruction. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Trouble the water, wait in the water, wait
Welcome back to part deux of the Tuesday edition of the Attitude with Artie Artisan. So as many of you know, I ran for governor in 1992. I was a state legislator. And when it comes to my issues, it was always about revenues and taxes. In fact, that's what I ran on in 1992. So I see an article at The Conversation, one of my absolute favorite places to go to. And the article was entitled, Plummeting Tax Revenues Will Put Governors in Tough Budget Situations. And I'm thinking, this is a conversation for every single state in the nation. This isn't state specific, it is generic. Joining us right now is the author of that piece. He's a professor of public policy at the University of Virginia. His name is Raymond Shepak. Is that correct, Raymond?
Correct. Good.
Okay. And, but what got me more excited than the fact that you teach at the University of Virginia or that you teach public policy is what you did for a whole number of years and that you worked for the National Governors Association. So Raymond, you worked for them for decades, I think, if I'm correct, looking at your bio. And that means that you have been looking at the issues of governors and budgets and challenges, and you respect what governors do, but you also recognize now more than ever how unique this situation is, because while we may have experienced a downturn in 2008, this feels like 2008 on steroids. And so your knowledge of governors and budgets is so valued right now. So welcome to the program. And tell us a little bit about the challenges for governors versus a challenge for a president and why this is such an extreme situation.
I also wrote something the other day which basically said there are two crises going on now from a gubernatorial standpoint. One is the coronavirus, which they're dealing with and pretty much on a daily basis and so on. And there are all kinds of problems with that, from, you know, the number of infections, the number of death rates, the overflow in hospitals. So that in itself is a huge, huge crisis. Right. But on top of that, okay, they're going to have this fiscal crisis, which is going to be bad. I suspect at least as bad as 2008, 2009. That's a big difference between governors and the president, really. The president can borrow, you know, $5-6 trillion, okay? Right. Governors, pretty much 49 out of the 50. I think the only one doesn't have some kind of a requirement, Vermont, but they tend to be pretty conservative anyway.
Exactly.
So it's a big difference because they can't really not only run deficits, a lot of them really are not able to borrow very much. So the combination set. So it forces them into a very unique situation of having to cut spending and or raise taxes. And the unique part about that is, as an economist, that weakens aggregate demand, makes the downturn in the economy deeper and longer.
Right, exactly.
And so it comes back, what's the federal government going to do now? Are they going to offset that decline, mm-hmm. which they did to some extent in 2009-2010?
So Raymond, as I'm looking at your article, by the way, fabulous article, I love the numbers. You go by total state expenditures by function for fiscal year 2019. Everyone's going, oh God, Artie. And I'm going, no. Because I remember when I was running for governor, this is 1992, I'm an old fart. And in 1992, I referred to Medicaid as the Pac-Man of our budget.
Right.
Okay. That it kept eating and eating and eating. And I am looking at Medicaid today and I'm thinking, okay, you had some significant Medicaid numbers, but of course we had full unemployment up until a couple of months ago.
Right.
But then a lot of states decided to embrace the expansion of Medicaid and the government, the federal government under the Affordable Care Act paid for most of that expansion. So it wasn't really a costly venture, although you still had to cough up some money. And now, Raymond, let's talk about Medicaid in April of 2020, because now everybody is unemployed, underemployed, they've seen their incomes decline, they may be waiting for an unemployment check that may not arrive till August. And now not only are people looking for food, not only are they trying to figure out how to pay for the rent, but guess how many new people are going to be Medicaid qualified, Raymond?
No, it's going to be huge. And because you've had 36 states expand Medicaid on up to about 140% of poverty. You know, the original program, single males were not eligible. And basically you had to have an income as an adult of pretty much under 50 or 60% of poverty to be eligible. So that expansion is huge. And it's most of the big states, the New Yorks, the Californias, the Illinois, are the ones that sort of have expanded. So you're going to get a huge number of people come onto the rolls. I mean, I just sort of did a back of the envelope kind of calculation. I looked back at 2009, 2010, and the rolls increased by about 14% in those 2 years. Wow. And so if you apply that, you're probably talking over the next 2 years, easily another $60 billion, you know.
Yeah, but let me just say something, Raymond. So I'm listening to some of the boys from the Federal Reserve Bank. And it depends on like where you're going to, who's doing it. And I saw a guy the other day say something about unemployment numbers. And his unemployment numbers ranged from like 12% to 42%. I'm going, that sweetheart is a huge range. He goes, which is why he said, I'm saying, expect an unemployment of around 30. Holy mackerel, 30%. So that's 30%. And in my state, we don't have an income tax, but in 30% unemployment for most states that have income taxes means that income has totally disappeared. For most states that depend on sales taxes, who's buying anything but food, which you don't really tax. Okay.
Right.
So you're not going out and buying, you know, another furniture set. It's just not happening because you're not even sure you're going to have an apartment, let alone need furniture. So all the things that sales taxes tax, people aren't buying. All the things that people you would pay with an income tax, people aren't receiving. And if you have a capital gains or an interest in dividends, guess what? Woo! We've seen the market completely bottom out. So as I'm looking at this, Raymond, one of the things I keep thinking about is if the federal government is going to step in to help, what would be the most effective way for the feds to step in? And I'm going to make a suggestion, and I just want to have you tell me whether this makes sense. They pick up Medicaid. They just pay for Medicaid. And since we know this is a health calamity anyway, and since we know it's the Pac-Man of state budgets, if they paid for Medicaid, guess what? That at least gives states an ability to breathe and rearrange some of the deck chairs.
No, that would be very big. And that has been on the table numerous times. I mean, when I was at the Governor's Association, it had policy on it. And we even, in fact, provided transition time so that that in fact would happen, because yes, it's the long-term care portion of Medicaid, which is the very expensive and the fastest growing one. Mm-hmm. So, and you probably remember Ronald Reagan like I do, but you know, he actually put on the table that possibility, and there were some discussions. It was a little bit about a year before my time at the mm-hmm. Governors Association, but that was discussed very much back there in the so-called Reagan swap, where the federal government would pick up Medicaid in exchange for states picking up more of transportation, welfare, wow, and other things.
Wow.
So it would have made a lot of sense, really. It still would make a lot of sense, because one of the other problems with Medicaid is the so-called dual eligible population. The people who are eligible get traditional medical care from Medicare, but they're also eligible because they're in a nursing home for Medicaid. And the problem is that's our most fragile population. And you have two levels of government basically involved in that. And stupid. What happens is the incentives are set up so that neither the states or the federal government is running it officially. So that's mm-hmm. a huge problem. And you would get rid of that problem if you move wow. towards one, you know, the federal government picking up that. So it
oh
makes,
my God, it makes
it
sense.
Makes a lot of sense on several different grounds.
So Raymond, that's your next article for the conversation. I'm just telling you why. But the other reason I mentioned Medicaid is that we're talking about this vulnerable population and who will be coming back after this pandemic. And it will be a struggle. People will be crawling back. So even if they have income, their incomes will be completely depleted. Even if they are coming back, we know that it's going to be a staggering of coming back. So the idea that people are accessing the healthcare system should not be an impediment for them coming back. But if they don't have access to a doctor, they may not be able to get the papers they need. They may not be able to get the tests they need. And you keep hearing from the insurance companies that they're going to cover you for COVID-19. what part of covering me do you, when do you stop? Because if I get very, very sick, I may have a permanent condition, Raymond. Are they going to cover my permanent condition?
Right.
You know, and that's what we're also seeing with people who got really ill from COVID-19. So I think in a lot of ways, if you want to turn an economy on, Raymond, that the idea of picking up this Medicaid, creating that efficiency with that dual population, making that a burden that's not no longer going to be placed on states, makes sense even for the economy coming back.
No, that's right. That's right. Particularly because states have a real problem in the decline of the night. They not only lose revenues on one side, they have this explosion of spending on the other. So right. They're hit really twice.
Right.
And so if you moved to Medicaid, you would at least get rid of that explosion in spending, would give them more stability in managing other programs.
So two of the states that we talk to on a regular basis are my little state of New Hampshire and that big whopping state of Texas. Okay, so we're heard on a station in Houston. And both states have this addiction, and it's an addiction to property taxes. And that is a real challenge going forward, because the beauty of a property tax is that they don't care whether you've got COVID-19. They don't care whether you lost your job. They don't care whether, you know, you're housebound and you can't go out, or you're a gig worker. And you property taxes basically say, here's the value of your property, send us this check, and that's it's over. So as I'm looking going forward, how do we deal with the property tax situation, since it is not, for the most part, income sensitive? I mean, some places may have a circuit breaker, or they may have some kind of a homestead exemption, but it's not usually not significant. And given what's going on now, states like state of Texas or my state of New Hampshire, people are terrified because they see burdens continue to increase, even as what they had in the way of income has basically disappeared. So how are governors going to have to look at that? Because that's part of a budget conversation, but sometimes it's been pushed to the county and city and town level, but yet it still is a problem for the gestalt called the state.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, traditionally, I mean, Texas and you are a little bit unique because you do have some property taxes.
Yeah,
most some states really don't tax property. They leave that to local governments. And the average state actually, probably 25 to 30% of state spending is actually contributions that go to local government, you know,
right,
particularly
right.
Education and so on. And, you know, there was deals struck long time ago that basically said, locals, you take property. States, we're going to take income and sales. And federal government, you stay out of sales. You stay income. And actually, it's worked pretty well. And there's a fair amount of coordination, because the federal government, when they do audits, they give those audits for income tax to states who yeah. can follow up and so on. So the system works pretty well. I do think most states ought to basically have more uniformity so that they're not too dependent on any one tax.
Yeah.
Because over the cycle, depending on the cycle and so on, sometimes sales tax get hit very hard, income mm-hmm. less so, corporate mm-hmm. income sort of less.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're going to find now is those states that are heavily dependent on sales tax are going to get hit the hardest, and they're going to get hit early. Okay.
Yes.
And in fact, I think it's going to end up being a lot worse, because there are a lot of firms so far are maintaining payrolls even though people can't work, which means they'll get income and it's going to be taxable. So I don't think income taxes will go down nearly as much as sales tax.
So I have a question for you. Since I come from a state that doesn't have an income tax, I'm sort of income naive. All right. So we now know that people are going to be applying for unemployment, and it's going to be difficult to find them. I mean, I think that's part of the problem. But that the other thing is that at least with this most recent bailout bill, that for a couple of months, they're going to get an additional $600 a week on top of their unemployment checks. That means a lot of people who are actually at the very bottom of the income strata are actually going to see a bonus, because they've never earned that much money
right. With
that additional 600. And of course, I know a lot of people right now who are working for local grocery stores who are really ticked off, Ray, because they're seeing, wow, if I was unemployed, I'd be making more money than if I was working at, you know, whatever it is, Shaw's, Market Basket, whatever the name of this store is. So are you able, with income taxes, to tax both unemployment benefits and this new $600 a week that the feds are now going to be contributing to unemployment? Is that ripe for the plucking when it comes to income?
Yeah, it varies by state, but I remember most states do not tax it. And I don't know, I didn't read closely this bill, but sometimes it precludes taxation in the particular bill, so we'd have to check it. But it is, I mean, you point to one of the problems too, which is only about 60% of people are currently covered by unemployment.
I know.
So this has now expanded it, but you're going to have a huge administrative nightmare getting those other 40% registered with states so that they can, in fact, get the money. So that's going to be a big problem.
Okay, so we're talking with Ray Shepak. He teaches at the University of Virginia, but the reason I adore him is that he ran the National Governors Association forever. So this is a really timely conversation. And so a friend of mine called me up and he had heard that I was going to interview you. And he said, so you've established priorities before you knew that the pandemic was going to happen. And those priorities were based on what you thought was going to be swollen coffers because you were doing so well economically, and now the bottom has dropped out. How do you reestablish your priorities, Ray, with significantly less money without harming the people on the bottom who have already been harmed because of the pandemic, because they're probably in a situation like a gig economy where even though they say the gig workers can qualify for unemployment, that's a bunch of garbage, I'll be honest with you. It's going to be very hard for them to get it. But how do you still maintain a level of priority and make sure that you protect those at the bottom? Because the pandemic plus an assault on their small revenues is just, it's a dual failure.
Yeah. Well, you got to bear in mind there are some protections for low-income people. Particularly with respect to so-called SNAP or food stamps.
Yeah.
That is an entitlement, okay?
Right.
Now, I think they're negotiating, trying to expand the eligibility for that and also provide higher levels of food per week for families. So if they're able to do that, and because that is an entitlement, it happens to be run by states, but it's 100% financed by the federal government. So
right.
That you will have continued protection. Medicaid also is an entitlement, okay? That's the one that so happens about 45% of the money that comes in there is from states, about 55% from the federal government. But again, it is an entitlement, so it does protect people. As the rolls swell, they will be able to sort of get the benefits.
So one of the things that we would suggest, remember I said that the feds pick up all of Medicaid, and now we're talking about food stamps, and that the feds actually they contribute more to food stamps, and that we could sort of expand, you know, who qualifies for food stamps and the amount you can get from food stamps. Would there also be a role now for HUD? That again, because housing is such an important issue, and that again, that level of vulnerability. I mean, I know a lot of people that qualify for Section 8, but they've never applied for Section 8. And the Section 8, it hasn't been incredibly vigorous anyway. Is this another opportunity for where the feds want to assist? Is what they can say is, okay, if I do the Section 8, do the food stamps, do the Medicaid, then as the state rearranges its priorities, what you've done is provided a safety net for those people in the most vulnerable situations. And then for the rest of us who will be pissed off, but if nothing else, we can survive as they make decisions on changing the revenue structure in order to pay for the basic needs.
Yeah. The other thing I would say is, I don't remember the exact number, but Section 8 is a pretty small program relative to
that. Oh, yeah.
It may be 10 or 15 billion, but food stamps, I think, is 80, 90 billion. Of course, Medicaid is several hundred billion. So the size of those are much bigger. The welfare money, they sort of eliminated that as an entitlement a number of years ago. So that's an area that is going to get squeezed quite a bit in this downturn.
Okay, Ken?
You know, Section 8 is not only a very small amount of money, but the waiting list is enormous. So in terms of actually helping people save their living places in a time of pandemic or really any other time. Poor people wait online for 2 years, 3 years to get to a point where they're even eligible to get into second.
So what I'm thinking though, Ray, is again, we're going to have to be creative, okay? Because this is just going to be, this is going to be a failing economy, and the level of vulnerability is going to be, I mean, you also want to create a level of stability because you don't want the emotional crises that happens when you don't have that stability. So is this an opportunity? And maybe at the Governors Association, did you talk about other forms of shelter assistance? And I don't mean Section 8. Section 8's an old, I agree with you, Ken. I used to work in housing. So it's, that's not the solution. But maybe given the nature of this calamity, that where we have food stamps and where we have Medicaid, maybe we need to have housing-cade, you know, where we come in and that way we've offered people a level of stability so that, again, if states have to make some revenue choices, people aren't going to have to choose between whether they can live someplace and whether they can have to pay for that additional burden.
Yeah, the only thing, I guess I would say a couple of things. Number one, if the federal government were to take over Medicaid, states would be, have a lot of excess revenues that they could, and I think what you would find them doing is experimenting in a lot of these particular areas.
Very good.
I've been involved a little bit in housing. I must say, as a public policy person and as an economist, I don't feel comfortable with any of the policies that we've got in that.
Boy, that's honest. I love it.
Yeah, I'm being honest. If you were to ask me how I would do it, you know, because so much of it really is support in the past, anyway, support for contractors and builders.
Exactly.
It doesn't seem to have worked very well. I think the voucher program is bigger, but it just doesn't work very well. So I think it's an area where if states had some additional revenue, they'd probably do a lot more experimentation and maybe figure out what works.
I've done a lot of work in housing, and I can tell you that it really is very, very expensive, and that is why there's a problem with our public policies. We used to have a lot of public housing, and that was funded by the government, and it was expensive, and more conservative governments got into power in Congress and the White House, and they cut back on public housing, and they wound up with this all kinds of private housing that is subsidized. So the government subsidized some, but you still need private builders to, or private rehabbers, whatever they are, to make their units available at below market rates, even with the federal subsidies. It's very difficult to make ends meet with more than, you know, a few units. And Housing Advocates had, about 25 years ago, when I was very involved with it, Housing Advocates willing to say, okay, just subsidize us so that we're not paying more than 40 or 50% of our income for rent. And
Ray, in property taxes, you know about the circuit breaker. And the circuit breaker says you shouldn't pay more than a certain percentage of your income in property taxes. Right. Well, maybe we should create a rental circuit breaker. And for people that qualify to a certain income, they shouldn't pay more than a certain percentage of their income for rent. And that way the dollars go directly into that situation. You also make sure that, again, you have to sort of cap what landlords do, because obviously landlords are going to say, oh, this is great, I can charge them anything. But yeah. I think you're right. We have to be creative. I got to ask one last question before we go. And again, I'm so glad that you teach at the University of Virginia and you write for theconversation.com. And we're talking about this huge thing that nobody wants to deal with, but it's going to blow up in our face, which is what's happening at state budgets. So as I was talking about Medicaid, one of the concerns I also have is that if you're a rich state, the feds only contribute 50 cents on the dollar for most Medicaid programs. If you're a poor state, the feds contribute like 80%. Okay. So even if the feds pick up Medicaid, the poor states are not going to get the same bang for their buck as the rich states, because the rich states are already, you know, doing a heavy lift for the Medicaid population. So once again, even for the poorer states who've been benefiting from Medicaid, we're still going to have to figure out something else to add to this, because they are going to be completely wiped out.
Yeah, that's true. And of course, you always wonder, you know, like a Mississippi now, you're right, that the federal government pays about 77%.
Right.
But those are all the states that haven't expanded either.
You know? Yes, you're right. You're absolutely right.
So it's and the deal that they cut way back in 1965 on the state sort of allocations, people have tried to breach that a few times, but they've never been able to. So it's a toughie because it's so big. And it really, Medicaid is the only program in the federal budget that essentially reallocates money through the tax system from wealthy states to low-income states. It's really the only one that has that European flavor to it.
And on that European note, I'm going to say thank you so much for joining us. The University of Virginia is very lucky to have you, and we're lucky that you joined us. Raymond Schepeck is a public policy person at the University of Virginia, and he was the former head of the National Governors Association. So when it comes to state budgets, he knows too much. Anyway, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Ciao. Bye-bye. All right, everyone. We will chat tomorrow. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes.
Paul and Silas bound in jail, had no money but to go their bail. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on,
hold on,
hold on,
hold on.
Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on, hold on,
hold on,
keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Paul and Silas began to shout. It was popped open and all walked out. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Hold on. Hold on. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Well, the only chains we can stand are the chains of hand in hand. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. On the freedom power, wouldn't take nothing from a journey now. Keep your eyes on the prize. Hold on. Hold on.
Hold on.
Hold on.
Hold on.
Keep your eyes.